From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Alex Cohen. Coming up, the FDIC prepares for more bank failures by creating more jobs.
First, let's make a deal. In Washington, the Bush administration agrees to a $300 billion housing package that's before Congress. It provides financial support to the besieged mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It also helps homeowners who are facing foreclosure.
Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson had asked President Bush to take back a veto threat over some disputed spending. Paulson said the bill sends a crucial message to the world to help the U.S. end the housing crisis. But will it? And how will we know?
How do we know what to make of anything in the economic news these days? That was the question when we called NPR's international economics correspondent Adam Davidson about signposts.
There's all sorts of data that comes out every day, and we report it, and frankly, most people tune it out and probably should because it changes so rapidly, and it's hard to get you really can't predict the future. There's this one number that I have gotten really obsessed with in the last, say, year that I think most people have never heard of, but I know it's what Ben Bernanke turns to right away, what the people who run big banks, probably Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. It's called the TED spread.
The TED spread, you're right. I certainly had never heard of it. What is it?
Yeah, and I hadn't heard of it until about a year ago when it became big news. So here's something we have a really hard time measuring: how much faith there is in the global economy. I mean, how would you measure that? How would you know? Well, the TED spread is about as close as you can get to measuring confidence in the whole system. And frankly, the numbers are kind of alarming. So what is the TED spread? It's the spread between overnight bank lending rates in the U.S. versus what banks in Europe charge overnight for U.S. dollars. A lot of gobbledygook, I know, but basically what it's saying is it is how much banks demand extra just in case the entire global economy goes belly up tonight, is roughly what it's measuring. Because when you borrow from the U.S. government in treasuries, that's pretty much a guarantee that that's good. So if you're borrowing from a major bank, you're a little worried maybe the whole system will go haywire in the next 12 hours.
So this is an overnight interest rate for essentially a 12-hour loan, and it's comparing U.S. rates versus European rates. Is that it?
Yeah, it's a very subtle thing, but it's about the closest thing we have to measuring how the people who run big banks, the people who run big insurance companies and others, how confident they are in the system. And what it's telling us is they've been less confident, but not a lot less confident. Just to give you numbers, and who cares what the numbers are really, but it's basically been below 50 or around 50 for most of the last century. It barely moves anywhere.
50, is this 0.50 or 50 what?
Yeah, it's 0.50. It's 50 basis points. So it's now close to 150. It's three times more fear, three times more worry. And it's gotten lower when people have felt more confident recently. I saw it as low as 80 not too long ago. And now it's almost twice as high as that. So that's a very alarming number. And because, I mean, the more I learn about economics, the more I realize it's really based on just faith and just different people all around the world believing that the system will work. And this is the number that tells us that, you know, people are worried that the system might not work.
So the TED spread, the measure of global confidence, this is a key figure to look at. And I'm really interested to hear that because I started off asking, where's the American economy going for the next 6 months? And it's tied into globalization and not just what's happening here, but happening elsewhere.
More than any crisis the U.S. has ever faced, far more, the world will determine how we do in this crisis. There's absolutely no question. And we will have a huge influence, obviously, on how the world does. It's intertwined. The crisis in the 70s and early 80s, that was a U.S. crisis, and the rest of the world was hurt by it, but we didn't really care what was going on in the rest of the world. But since then, things have changed completely, and we really care what's going on in the rest of the world.
Okay, but, you know, we do still care about some numbers here in this country. Unemployment, for instance. Unemployment remains a pretty important number, doesn't it? It's running about 5.5%. I remember when 5% was considered full employment. So it doesn't sound so awful.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at unemployment over the history of the U.S., this is not a particularly dramatically high unemployment rate. But it's the trend that you worry about, and you worry about that number continuing to get higher and higher. And the reason it's so important is we talk about so many things in the economy. We talk about, you know, interest rates and the stock market and the TED spread and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, we need people working. I mean, that's what this is all about. People earning money, paying their rent, getting food on the plate, et cetera. And if the economy cannot provide a healthy number of people jobs, then the economy isn't working, no matter what those other numbers say. So unemployment is probably the crucial number from that perspective.
Okay, we've talked about unemployment, and you've introduced this TED spread. Maybe I'm in error here because I'm basically looking for signposts, and maybe there aren't any signposts. I don't know.
I think that always it's hard to predict the future. Always the economists and others are looking, you know, through a glass darkly. It's very confusing looking at all these little discrete bits of data, coming up with an overall narrative and figuring out where you are. But this crisis is, I would guess, the hardest one ever. In the past, when we had the 87 stock market crash, the late 90s bond crisis all over the world, the 70s inflation, even the Great Depression, the numbers were ugly, but we knew what the mechanics of the crisis were. This one, we don't even know the mechanics of the crisis. We don't even know what's not working. There are fundamental questions being asked about whether or not our financial system works right now. That is a totally different level of concern than what we've seen in the past. And I think that's what's got a lot of economists really scratching their heads and scouring the data and just not finding the clarity they'd like.
Well, clarity always helps in a situation that involves money. But is there anything here that you could look at and say, here's the other hand, okay? Don't we, as journalists, we always look on the other hand. Where's the other hand?
Right. I mean, I think that's a really crucial question. I think that we, obviously, this is bad. This feels bad. But I do want to say that there is a reasonable chance that however painful it is right now, what is happening in the economy is good for America in the long term. It reminds me of myself several years ago when I finally had a year or two where I paid off my college debts, I paid off my silly credit card debts, and I prepared myself for adulthood. And it was a lousy couple years, but it prepared me for a more responsible adulthood. And that may be what the U.S. is going through. We are fixing the excesses of credit. We are fixing the excesses of spending more than we earn. We are transitioning into a new kind of economy where Americans save more, where we export more to the rest of the world rather than buy so much from the rest of the world. And that could be a really good thing. But I think any economist would tell you it's going to be a pretty tough few months or even a couple years before we start feeling the benefits of that.
NPR's Adam Davidson. He covers international business for NPR. Adam, thank you, I guess.
Thank you, Alex.
As Adam mentioned, it's impossible to predict the future, but there are signs that more banks are in danger of failing. That was the word from Sheila Blair, the chairwoman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, this week. Blair was in San Francisco yesterday to assure consumers that even if their banks fail, their money will be protected. That's just part of what the FDIC does. For more on their role in the U.S. economy, here's NPR's Elise Spiegel.
Chris Etzler got the call about 45 minutes before his daughter's graduation. It was a Friday in May, around 6 p.m., when Etzler, who's mayor of Staples, Minnesota, population 3,000, was told that the FDIC had staged a surprise takeover of the town bank. Would he please come down and meet with them?
I mean, my first reaction is, you know, it's my daughter's graduation, and but, you know, you're being asked by you know, the federal government to show up at the bank, and so I made my way over there.
There he found a scene unlike any other he had ever encountered in his small railroad community.
All these suits, you know. There were more suits in town that day than, you know, than we see in a long time around here. So a lot of suits, and it was just kind of seemed to be kind of chaos inside the building at that time.
FDIC employees ushered him into a conference room, past men and women who were literally opening rolls of coins to count every penny. They sat him down and explained that the bank, First Integrity, had failed, that FDIC employees would spend the night taking account of all of its assets, but by morning the bank would be reopened. The FDIC had found a new company to run it. Etzler says he was surprised. He had no idea that this was coming. No one did. Not the bank employees, not the townspeople. The FDIC had been completely clandestine about the whole thing.
They set up shop over at another community 30 miles from here and went under false names, and they scouted out where to park cars and everything in town so that they wouldn't come in with 30 vehicles.
Why? The FDIC wanted to avoid a run on the bank. In fact, while they are occasionally forced to negotiate the takeover of failed banks like First Integrity, avoiding bank runs is really the central function of the FDIC. So what is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation? Where did it come from and what does it do? Jeffrey Miller, a professor of banking law at New York University, explains that the FDIC was born out of the trauma of the Great Depression.
After 1933, when essentially all banks in the United States failed, Congress responded with a fundamental statute, which, among other things, established deposit insurance as a basic policy of federal banking regulation.
Miller says this creation of deposit insurance, the guarantee that customers will be paid up to $100,000 of their deposits even if their banks fail, has fundamentally altered the psychology of the consumer.
So individuals with money in banks, even if they see on the news that Citibank has had record losses or JPMorgan Chase's problems, they don't need to worry. Their deposits will be protected. And that's had an important impact. It's been extremely effective at preventing massive bank panics of the type that happened in the Depression.
In fact, half a century passed without a banking crisis after the FDIC was created. It wasn't until the savings and loan episode in the 1980s that a large number of banks failed, literally hundreds. In the current environment, only 5 banks have collapsed. But, says Miller, it's difficult to predict what will happen.
Somebody once said that if you've seen one banking crisis, you've seen one banking crisis, which means that they're all different. We're in a brave new world here, and we've got to face conditions that we've never seen before.
The FDIC certainly seems to be preparing for whatever may come. In late February, it placed a large number of job postings in newspapers. The FDIC said it was looking for people with, quote, skill in performing duties associated with financial institution closing. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Alex Cohen. Okay, so far we've decoded the FDIC, and we've heard about the TED spread, that economic indicator, which helps us figure out if things are getting worse or not. Now we take questions from you about this banking crisis.
Last week we asked listeners, what are you worrying about? What do you want to know? What are your questions to help with answers? We've called James Early. He's a senior analyst at The Motley Fool.
Our first question comes from listener Hugh Henry, and he wonders what happens to your loans if your lending institution goes bust.
Well, fortunately, this is actually the easier part of a bank failure. The FDIC has mentioned, at least in the case of IndyMac, which was the second biggest bank failure ever, that you just keep paying your loans as normal. Your ATM card works the same. Your checks work the same. Nothing really changes on that end. I think if there's one thing people can count on is that when you owe somebody else money, they'll find you and make sure you can pay them conveniently.
Here is a question about retirement savings. It comes from Sarah Hansen, and she's been listening to her mom's advice. She's been diligently putting away money into her IRA every month, but the bank failures have her feeling a bit nervous, and she wants to make sure her IRA is safe.
Well, first of all, good for you, Sarah. I mean, if we all put away money into an IRA every month, it would be a much more stable financial situation in this country. On the IRA question, just as bank deposits are guaranteed, IRAs and retirement accounts at banks are also guaranteed in the sense of the deposits they have inside of them. In other words, if you have a CD in an IRA, you're actually guaranteed up to $250,000 for that account, whereas just with a regular deposit or savings account, it's only $100,000. So it's a pretty good guarantee. Hopefully, nothing happens that you have to claim that guarantee, but on the whole, if you have that money in IRA, that's guaranteed.
A number of our listeners recall the great savings and loan bailout of the 1980s, and they wanted to know how that worked out for individuals, for the government. What was the total cost in the end, and who took the biggest hit?
In the end, the total cost was about $160 billion. And the biggest hit was taken by us, taxpayers, to the tune of $125 billion. I think I read it would be about $250 billion these days in inflation adjusted. So it's a lot of money. I think it was 747 savings and loans failed. So to compare, we've had just a handful of bank failures. So we're on a lot better ground right now. There are certain similarities. Yes, these SNLs got way into real estate and they shouldn't have. And similarly, we have a lot of banks who are overextended into real estate. But just in terms of the magnitude, I think we're on a lot better footing, and I wouldn't expect this to get anything like the SNL crisis.
James Early of The Motley Fool responding to your questions about money. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Farmington, New Mexico this week has even more teenagers in cowboy boots and hats. They've come from all over the country for the National High School Rodeo Championships. It calls itself the world's largest rodeo. New Mexico hopes that this rodeo and others like it are big enough to boost local businesses. As Eric Mack reports, it does seem to be working.
If you've ever heard of the tiny village of Abiquiu in northern New Mexico, you probably know it as Georgia O'Keeffe country. But for many of the locals here, this has always been rodeo territory. Tonight, locals and fans from around the state pour into the new rodeo grounds north of town.
All right, guys, we're ready to rodeo.
This is one of the newest rodeos in the state, and it's a big deal around here. More than 1,000 fans showed up this weekend, about the same number of people who live in this entire river valley. Joe Kyle has been preaching the gospel of rodeo in the state for years now. He's tonight's rodeo pastor. And he says rodeo in New Mexico has started to hit the big time.
It's been pretty steady, strong. PRCA is really kicking tail here in New Mexico. I mean, they're just going bangers all over the place.
The PRCA he mentioned, the one that's going bangers, is the Pro Rodeo Cowboys Association, the major leagues of rodeo. A lot of the credit goes to the state's Rodeo Council, formed by Governor Bill Richardson back in 2005. The idea is to give the state's rural areas a much-needed economic boost by promoting local rodeos. Caroline Invicta Stevenson is on the Rodeo Council. She says another goal is to help preserve a Western lifestyle that's been slowly paved over in recent decades.
And a lot of that had gotten away from us because of everything that had evolved in the cities. Rodeo is just a way of life. It's sort of what soccer is to a lot of our children that, you know, grow up sort of in the mid-cities.
So far, the Rodeo Council has handed out $4.5 million to improve rodeo facilities, attract more PRCA events, and cover some of the costs of putting on the actual rodeos. The council's biggest success story so far has been with the Rodeo de Santa Fe. It was in a slump until this year when it got a $30,000 grant to increase prize money. Chris Simrod is the rodeo's marketing director. He says the bigger prize money helped draw twice as many competitors as the year before, including some of the sport's biggest names.
Without that money, we would have been stuck in this rung of our rodeo size. It never would have allowed us to jump to the next level. But it's amazing how doubled the contestants, doubled people in the stands, doubled probably the economic impact to the rodeo as well as the community as a result.
The Rodeo Council is also thinking long term. Stevenson says they're working to make New Mexico the permanent home for both the junior high and high school championships, and they've already put over $1 million into college programs and scholarships. All of that helped catch the attention of one young rider who's in the chute at the Rio Arriba Rodeo tonight.
Rockland O'Neill, our Australian cowboy, up next. Go ahead now, look at this. Hey-o! Yard dart.
That's Lachlan O'Neill having a rough ride in the saddle bronc competition. He hails from Brisbane, Australia. He just stepped off a plane in Albuquerque a few days ago, and this is his first rodeo stateside.
So I come over just to further my career. Heard about the coach and then looked into it a bit more and seen how big it really was. So yeah, so looks like a good place, yeah.
O'Neill plans to ride in this week's high school finals in Farmington. Then it's on to Mesa College in the dusty town of Tucumcari, New Mexico. A place most Americans probably haven't heard of, let alone Australians. Unless maybe you're looking for a good coach to help you launch your rodeo career. For NPR News, I'm Eric Mack in Taos, New Mexico.
A Okay, you might have grown up reading classic picture books like Goodnight Moon, Frog and Toad, The Cat in the Hat, my personal favorite, Ant and Bee. Your kids now have lots of other options. But are books inspired by PG-13 films like The Dark Knight and Iron Man really appropriate for the youngest of readers? We'll weigh the pros and the cons of a new crop of kids' books. That's coming up later in the program. This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen.
I'm Alex Chadwick. Coming up, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter with the story of why he's quitting the Chicago Tribune.
But first, Warren Jeffs, the leader of the polygamist group FLDS, has been indicted in Texas for the sexual assault of underage girls. Other members of the group were also charged yesterday.
These criminal cases focus on the FLDS practice of pairing girls who are still minors with older men, even when some are relatives.
NPR's Howard Berkus has been covering polygamy and the FLDS for many years, and he joins us now from Salt Lake City. And Howard, what are these new charges in Texas, and what prompted them?
Warren Jeffs and four of his followers were charged with sexual assault of a child. And that's defined in Texas law as a girl under 17 who's not legally married or cannot be legally married to the alleged assailant. That's a first-degree felony in Texas, and it's punishable by jail terms of from 5 to 99 years upon conviction. And now one of the defendants is also charged with bigamy, and a sixth FLDS member is charged with failure to report child abuse. All these charges stem from that raid in April on the FLDS ranch outside El Dorado, Texas, in which, you remember, hundreds of children were taken into custody. Texas said those kids were being abused, but failed to prove that in court, and all those children were eventually returned to their parents. But investigators still have a treasure trove of documents, and it's believed that those documents, plus DNA testing and grand jury testimony of group members, triggered these charges.
The raid you mentioned was prompted by a phone call that was thought to be from an abused girl at the FLDS ranch, but now it seems that call was likely a hoax. Might that be a problem for prosecutors?
That's a really good question. There's a woman in Colorado who has made hoax child abuse phone calls to authorities before. And one of the calls that prompted the Texas raid was traced to a cell phone that she apparently used in another hoax call. So that raises the question of whether any evidence seized in the raid is what lawyers call fruit from the poisonous tree. Is that evidence that was tainted, is it inadmissible because it resulted from a tainted act, a raid based on false information?
FLDS leader Warren Jeffs is named in these indictments. How is this charge different from the other charges he's faced before and faces now?
This is the first time that Warren Jeffs is accused of committing a sexual crime directly. And the indictment is so graphic about this, it's not something we really want to describe in detail because there might be children listening. But in Utah, Jeffs was convicted of facilitating rape. He had presided over one of these so-called spiritual marriages, a marriage not recognized by the state, involving a 14-year-old girl and her 19-year-old first cousin. And he ignored her when she said she wasn't ready for that marriage and she wasn't ready for the sex that followed. In Arizona, Jeffs is awaiting trial on charges he facilitated sexual misconduct with a minor. Again, in his role as FLDS prophet, he presided over this underage marriage. But in Texas, the indictment accuses Jeffs of committing the sexual crime himself. And you may remember that after the raid on the FLDS ranch in Texas, authorities released photographs of Warren Jeffs in which he's cradling and passionately kissing a girl who was identified as being 12 years old. The indictment isn't clear about whether she's the girl he's accused of assaulting.
Howard, this practice of marrying underage girls, is it part of the religious doctrine of FLDS?
It's hard to know where that really comes from because the FLDS members don't talk to outsiders about their faith. They don't describe their religious tenets. What seems clear to me, though, is that you remember that this is a fundamentalist faith. It's a faith based on religious practices that existed more than 100 years ago and existed at a time in our country when pioneers were crossing the country where there was sparse settlement in the West and where there weren't many women to go around. And there often were marriages involving young girls. We recoil at that now, but that was more common practice back then. And this is a group that essentially lives sort of in a 19th century way and may have found this kind of practice acceptable. The group has disowned this practice recently in response to the raid in Texas. They say they will not engage in these underage marriages anymore.
NPR's Howard Berkus, thank you.
Thank you.
From NPR News, it's Day to Day. Financial trouble at one of the most authoritative newspapers in the country. Today's second quarter report from the New York Times shows a drop in revenues and in profits again. Marketplace's John Dimsdale joins us. John, how bad are things at the Times?
Well, they reported a 6% slide in their earnings, which is a lot worse than Wall Street was anticipating. And part of the decline was due to employee buyouts. Like many newspaper publishers, The Times is trimming its news staff. And that's ultimately going to cost the company about $40 million extra dollars this year alone. Also, ad revenue at The Times dropped 11%, and that's largely from a slowdown in classified ads. Longtime newspaper analyst John Morton says that reflects the sluggish economy we're in.
The three major sources of classified are automotive, real estate, and job formations. And all three of those sources are in a tailspin. It won't get better until those sources come back, and I don't think anybody anticipates that happening this year.
The chief executive at The Times, Janet Robinson, says that ads from airlines and hotel owners and car makers were also way down this past quarter.
John, the New York Times is a very active online site as well. How about online advertising kind of balancing things out here?
Yeah, it was a healthy 13% jump in internet revenue, but that's still a relatively small part of the paper's overall income. The increase in online ads is nowhere near as much as the paper's been losing in print ads. And the internet, as you say, is really where the Times and all newspapers have to look for their future. Readers are moving there, newspapers are going to have to follow, but John Morton says management at newspapers aren't making the transition very smooth.
Unfortunately, what a lot of newspaper companies are doing in the interim is cutting back on news staff, on content, at a time when the standing and brand name of newspapers is paramount in importance to succeeding on the internet.
Morton says the industry is shooting itself in the foot by lowering its journalism standards just when establishing a presence on the internet will need strong news coverage to attract online readers who have so many other choices.
We're going to have more on that in a moment, but just give us the overall readership trends for printed newspapers now.
Yeah, the old-style papers, they've been steadily declining for a long time, really, since the late 1980s. And the recent migration to online news is just cutting even more deeply into traditional subscriptions, with a corresponding drop in the advertising revenue for traditional newspapers.
Thanks, John. John Dimsdale of Public Radio's daily business show, Marketplace.
This is Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Alex Cohen.
I'm Alex Chadwick. One more item on newspapers now. The Chicago Tribune. Chicago real estate billionaire Sam Zell bought it and other associated papers, including the Los Angeles Times and Baltimore Sun and more last year. There have been a lot of layoffs since then. And this week, the resignation of Trib reporter Maurice Posley. He just helped the paper win another Pulitzer Prize this year, and his stories about the wrong men on death row led Illinois to stop executions. Maurice Posley, welcome to Day to Day. In your letter of resignation, you write that there's been a, quote, stunning dismantling of our newspaper. What do you mean?
This current round of layoffs, which is going to occur by the end of August, when we're going to lose about 60 bodies, is essentially the third round of either voluntary buyouts or layoffs in the last 2.5 years. And we're seeing a flow of institutional memory go out the door that I believe is pretty much unprecedented, certainly in modern times. I've been there almost 25 years. I've never seen anything like it.
Sam Zell had a
conversation with Tribune Company reporters yesterday by phone with people who work at papers all around the country. He told the reporters, we're looking at some of the worst advertising numbers in the history of the world. We're doing everything we can to save jobs and papers in the long run. You understand that he's in not good circumstances.
I think that's pretty clear. You know, the guy doesn't have the money, he doesn't have the money. It just is so stunning to have occurred so quickly. You know, when he came in, he says, my idea is not, you don't cut your way to success. Well, he's selling properties, he's cutting, he's slashing. You know, for 25 years, I walked into that newspaper and I was pretty confident. Almost every day, I didn't know what I particularly might be doing that day, but I was pretty confident that there was going to be time, space, and resources to do good journalism. And the uncertainty of it now is that who knows about time? I think, you know, each day can be potentially a new reality. And there are no guarantees now.
You wrote a letter to your colleagues about your decision to offer to resign. And in it, you say, I'm thankful for this newspaper's commitment to truth and justice. And you go on to say, now's the time for me to seek my fortunes elsewhere. Where would that be?
You know, I'm pursuing I've got lines in the water, you say, but I've also got some options here that would involve using my skills in a non-journalistic way that could accomplish some of these same goals that we had and accomplished at the Tribune.
You are a co-winner of a Pulitzer Prize this year. Just a moment of incredible triumph for any reporter. And you're talking about your non-journalistic future.
This was the hardest decision I've ever made professionally. I'm fearful personally of 2 years from now at age 60, looking back and being angry and frustrated and bitter. And life is too short for that. Who is sure that these guys have the formula? Now, they're trying to do things to save the paper. I told some of my editors when I had conversations with them about leaving that, you know, you're telling me that you have a commitment to public service journalism, and I believe what you're telling me. What I don't know is if you're going to get the horses.
Maurice Posley is an investigative reporter resigning from the Chicago Tribune. He expects to be gone within a month. Maurice, thank you and good luck.
Thank you very much.
Back now with Day to Day. The Batman sequel, The Dark Knight, broke box office records this last weekend. No surprise there. But the critical acclaim is more than most people expected. Real raves for Heath Ledger as the Joker. As critic Andrew Wallenstein says, that means an opportunity come Oscar time.
When the Academy Award nominations for Best Supporting Actor are announced next year, I'll bet anything Ledger will be among them. Critics are practically tripping over themselves to praise his chilling portrayal of Batman nemesis, the Joker.
Why don't we cut you up into little pieces and feed you to your pooches? And then we'll see how loyal a hungry dog really is.
That a comic book character is generating Oscar buzz seems a little strange. The awards are traditionally dominated by so-called prestige pictures. These are typically art house dramas, high on artistic integrity, but low on box office receipts. And that could be one reason the ratings for the Oscar telecast on ABC each year have been in a death spiral, 2008 being the lowest yet. After all, why should a mass audience feel invested in films most of them have never seen? Like, say, last year's Oscar darling, Atonement.
Yes, I saw him.
Just as you see me.
I know it was him.
You know it was him? Well, you saw him.
But here's the thing about Ledger. He's not the only one in a popcorn movie this time of year that gave a great performance. So perhaps it's time Oscar voters start to reevaluate just what their standards are. I mean, let's face it, there is an elitist bias on the award circuit against movies that make a lot of money. It wasn't always this way. Titanic and Lord of the Rings were huge Oscar winners in their day. But now it's as if quality could not possibly exist within a film intended to drive quantity. But I don't think many people see the two as mutually exclusive. Take, for instance, Robert Downey Jr.'s work in another mega-successful summer film, Iron Man. It's worthy of a Best Actor nomination. I don't think the film was all that good, but his individual performance was as good as any I've seen this year.
It's an imperfect world, but it's the only one we've got. I guarantee you, the day weapons are no longer needed to keep the peace, I'll start making bricks and beans for baby hospitals.
You rehearse that much?
every night in front of the mirror before bedtime.
Should Downey be disqualified from contention because he happened to spend a portion of the film flying around in a metal suit? I hope not. If metal is a deal-breaker, that could also bode badly for WALL-E, the animated tale of a lonely robot. WALL-E is probably the best movie I saw this summer. Every year, Pixar seems to produce top-notch movies that only get noticed in secondary categories. But isn't it high time for a Best Picture nod? Hell, I'd settle for a secondary category like Best Screenplay for Judd Apatow, the writer-producer responsible for just about every great comedy the past 3 years. He was ignored for The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up. Can we get him something, anything, for Forgetting Sarah Marshall or Pineapple Express, just two of the comedies he's attached to this year? Of course not. Oscar seems blind to anything but drama, though I'd pit a great comedy like Knocked Up, or even a great action movie like The Bourne Ultimatum, against anything nominated in recent years. Mainstream movies are capable of achieving a quality worthy of Oscar recognition. Maybe it's time to do some recognizing, if for no other reason than saving the Oscars from obscurity.
Andrew Wallenstein is a deputy editor at The Hollywood Reporter.
Even if The Dark Knight and Iron Man don't get those Oscar nominations, they both have already been honored in other ways by being turned into children's books. Books based on big brands have been around for a while, but the recent trend of books intended for the youngest of readers adapted from PG-13 films is troubling to some parents. Erica Pearl is a parent, and she's been writing about this topic for Slate. She joins us now. Erica, thanks for joining us. And tell us, why are publishers putting out books with titles like I Am Iron Man and A Hero Called the Hulk? Is SpongeBob SquarePants suddenly not a big draw anymore?
You know, it's interesting. It seems like there's a general trend of taking fare that's geared towards older kids and trying to shift it downward. And we're seeing this across the boards with toys and media. And it seems that early readers are sort of the next landscape for that.
Some of these early reader books are based on films that have very adult themes. You know, in Iron Man, you see the main character going out and getting drunk. Do these themes come up at all in these kids' books?
Not so much. You're not going to see Iron Man getting drunk in a children's book. But you will see some of the things from the movies watered down in some of the early reader books that are out there. Other early readers will have the same branding as the movies, but then they will just completely ignore the plot altogether. And it will basically, underneath the cover, be just a book about Batman or a book about Iron Man.
And it would seem with that kind of branding, it wouldn't be too extraordinary for these young kids to read the book and then say to mom and dad, I want the Happy Meal and I want the toys. Do these books kind of push these products?
Absolutely. And these movies have been criticized for that in other arenas. Iron Man has certainly been criticized for doing Burger King toy promotions and ads on Nickelodeon. The Hulk had some ads for a candy product that was going on Cartoon Network. But for some reason, there's sort of this, if it's an educational book, these guys can fly under the radar, if you'll excuse the pun.
Is there any benefit to these books? Can they help children to start learning how to read?
A lot of parents are saying, I don't care that it's about Batman or Superman or whoever. If my kid wants to read it and gets excited about reading, that's great by me. And, you know, as a parent, I'm very, very sympathetic to that. I guess my concern is that these are sort of the literary equivalent of junk food in a lot of cases, carrying the same I can read label from the imprint and reading leveling systems that are on the classic early readers like Frog and Toad and Little Bear and all those things. They're on the same shelf with the same labeling on them.
Based on what you've seen so far, what do you think the future is of these early reading books?
You know, I'm troubled about the idea that the motion picture industry is somehow kind of reaching younger and younger to kids. And it's funny that it seems particularly to boys, because you're not seeing, you know, PG-13 movies like Mamma Mia are not being turned into early readers. But for some reason, they're sort of thinking that the only way you can connect with boys is through incredibly violent imagery and incredible, you know, ties to adult content. And there are early readers out there that connect with boys in a variety of different ways. There's also books like the Fly Guy series that Ted Arnold did and Dave Pilkey's Captain Underpants. There are some great books that do kind of capture the imagination of young boys, but not by just taking adult content and feeding it to them.
Mother and writer Erica Pearl, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Lava, lava. Lava, lava. Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Alex Cohen.
And I'm Alex Chadwick.